You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan occupies so many chapters in America's musical history. Mark at least one of those chapters for the gloriously loud and messy stories of Detroit's punk scene.
Chicks, cars, so American. Drugs, bars, they're so American. Well, I'm not gonna try to tell you.
Detroit writer and music journalist Rob St. Mary has just finished producing a new two-disc set of music called The End of Night, 1967 to 1983, from the Detroit Punk Archive, which Rob maintains. This collection is a fast and furious introduction to the scene. If you were there, you'll hear bands you know, like the Mutants here. But Rob also uncovered some previously unpublished recordings and stories. Rob St. Mary, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Rob, when people hear about Detroit punk, maybe especially people outside the region, I think their minds probably go straight to the MC5 or the Stooges. But for the purposes of this project, that's not actually what you're talking about.
Well, the thing for me is there's really kind of three eras. And I think some people, as you say, look at the late 60s, what I would call proto-punk bands, or they go to the early 80s and they talk about the hardcore scene. So it's Negative Approach, the Necros, things like that, the stuff that happened around the Freezer scene, both of which are amazing scenes, and they've both been written about extensively. But I always kind of felt that there was a scene that was in there in between that kind of got lost. And partly, I think that has to do with the fact that there were really no big breakout bands. There was one band that came out of that scene, and that would be the Romantics. And they don't really represent the totality of the sound. And as with any sort of creative scene, there's really not one sound. So I think that might be part of it, part of the reason why it is kind of overlooked. So the period that I look at is basically right around 76, 77 through to the early 80s. There's a little bit of an overlap with the hardcore scene, but the hardcore scene is its own thing. I'm mostly focused on this late 70s period, and specifically the bands that came through a place called Bookies Club 870.
Right.
And why that scene was so important.
Could you talk about the club?
Yeah, it's a fascinating place. It was actually the second Cliff Bell's location. So back in the 1940s, it was a jazz supper club, went through a series of owners. And then by 1970, this guy by name of Sam Bookie Stewart bought the place. And Bookie had been, some people say, an illegal bookmaker during Prohibition. And he had been a bar manager for a series of what had been gay clubs since the end of World War II. Brought in some of the first drag shows in the 1950s. And then when he bought this club in 1970 in Palmer Park on the Highland Park border there, it was pretty run down. It was sort of an older gay man's drinking club during the day. And then around February of 78, these kids started coming in and say, hey, can we book the room? Because people won't allow us to play. Most of the bars at the time wanted cover bands. They wanted bands to play basically top 40 hits. And I talked to people who were in the scene and they said, you know, I work on the line all day. The last thing I want to do is be a human jukebox.
Yeah.
So they found this club. They went in there. They started booking it. And within about 6 months, they ended up taking over the entire schedule. And they started bringing in bands from around the area who were locals, as well as well-known national and international acts. So, for example, just looking at the Midwest, you had bands like Pure Ubu and the Cramps, the Dead Boys, John Cale, who was in Velvet Underground, came and play. You had people from the UK, such as Ultravox. The Police, on one of their first tours when they were in a van, played at Bookies to about 50 people. It's one of those kind of Woodstock stories that everybody says they were there, but really only about 50 people were there to see the Police that night. So it became this club, and what it showed is that there was a real interest in original music, and that opened the door for more venues to open. And actually, the guys who booked Bookies went on to open a place called Clutch Cargos and then opened St. Andrew's Hall, which had been a Scottish Benevolent Society club downtown in Detroit, and turned it into the concert venue we all know it is today.
You alluded to the fact that a lot of the people in these bands had other jobs and, you know, whole other pieces of their lives. What can you tell us about, I mean, this is an incredibly diverse bunch of bands and incredibly diverse bunch of people in them, but what can you tell us about the lives of the people who played these songs?
It is really a blend. I mean, you've got auto workers, guys who are working on the line. You've got people who are trying to be artists and writers. A lot of them went on, and this was where my interest came in when I did the Orbit book previously, and this whole thing is an offshoot of that, was that a lot of them were writers and artists who eventually went on to do alt publishing, including Orbit magazine. So to me, this is kind of a genesis point for that. It became a place where sort of the freaks, the outsiders, the weirdos all came together, because you have to remember in that period in the 1970s, especially this period, it was singer-songwriters, it was prog rock, it was big arena rock. And it just wasn't speaking to these folks. They were looking for something that wasn't that, that you didn't have to be a classically trained musician or something like that in order to go on stage and present ideas and songs that matter to you.
You know, the fact that there weren't really breakout bands as we understand them in this group, and yet there are fingerprints of people like Wayne Kramer all over some of these tracks. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Wayne went to prison, which he's talked about, in the mid-70s. And when he got out, he came back to Detroit and he produced two of the tracks that are on the record, one by the Cubes and another by the Cadillac Kids. So he was part of the scene. The thing that I find really interesting about this scene in Detroit was that when we look at, say, the New York scene around CBGB's, a lot of those bands, especially when you talk about the Ramones, I remember Danny Fields talking, who was the manager, who talked about the Ramones, and he said they were four guys who didn't really like each other, but they all liked the Stooges. So other punk scenes, like you look at the Damned's first record, you look at the Sex Pistols' first record, there's covers of Stooges songs on those albums. So these other scenes were really influenced by what had happened before, as we talked about in the late 60s. So these guys actually, this scene in the late 70s, actually featured people who had been in that scene. So you had bands like Destroy All Monsters. You had the bands that Wayne Kramer kind of built and, you know, fell apart. You had Sonic's Rendezvous Band, which was Fred Sonic Smith from the MC5. So there was this crossover of these older folks who were coming into the scene and hanging out with people who were influenced by that, who maybe had saw the Stooges, you know, at their high school or the MC5, you know, or saw them back at the Grandy when they were really young and sneaking into shows. So that influence really does carry over. But at the same time, I think a lot of them were trying to take what was brought by that earlier scene and kind of expand on it. So you see a real range of sound in here. You hear real sort of fast 77 style stuff. You hear things that are obviously not only influenced by the MC5 and the Stooges, but even Alice Cooper. I mean, if you listen to the Sillies, at times it sounds a bit like Alice Cooper. So there's just a really interesting range. And then there's even stuff that I think we wouldn't even call it that yet, but feels more like proto-punk, maybe something like what Public Image Limited would do, or Pere Ubu, or more of the arty.
Just hinting on the edge of new wave there.
Right. And yeah. And then by the time we get to the final tracks that are in here, especially the last one from Mr. Unique and the Leisure Class that finishes the album from 83, that one to me feels like, you know, new wave. It's XTC. It's got this political humor that I think is equal to something like the Dead Kennedys. So, I mean, there's really a range in there that's fascinating. And that's what was so interesting for me about putting it together.
Rob, you pulled this together with funding in part from a Knight Foundation grant. And maybe there's just a touch of dissonance there. Using money like that for a punk archive feels like getting a grant for street art. But what did the money allow you to do that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to?
Sure. I had originally, to kind of tell you the evolution of this, I had put in for a Knight Arts Challenge grant. And originally, I wanted to do it as a book. And some of the people who I'd interviewed for the Orbit book, I had about 50 people, and there was a lot of this stuff that was in the first part of the book that I expanded on. And I thought, well, you know, I'll do kind of a please kill me oral history of just this scene. And Knight came back and said, yeah, we're not really interested in publishing books. You got anything else? And I said, well, how about this? I'll create an archive website where I can host these interviews and stories and everything else that I learn and keep updating it and put out a record set. And they said, sounds great. So I went out and I was able to raise $15,000. They gave me $15,000 towards that. That $15,000 that they gave me went towards building the archive site and working on some other elements of the piece. And then the donations actually went towards creating the record set. So it was kind of a split between the two.
Were there surprises here for you, even as steeped as you are in all this history?
I mean, just the tracks, just finding the tracks and some of the stuff that I was able to find and sort of odd crossover and things like that. So, for example, one of the sort of boombox demos that's in here is with a band called Route 666 that was actually recorded in what is now the Zen Center here in Hamtramck, where I live. It used to be a rehearsal space for bands. And the guy who's the guitarist on that is a guy by the name of Norman Westberg. And Norman Westberg, after Route 666 kind of fell apart, he moved to New York and joined Swans. So he's been in Swans since 1980. So you've got a guy like that who, as I was saying, you know, really steeped in sort of that post-punk New York no-wave scene coming out of here. So I think that's really interesting. I think that, as I talked about earlier, the Mr. Unique song, which has a title that some people said, you know, they kind of looked at me and said, are you sure you want to put that on the record?
We're not going to say it on this family public radio program right now.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. I mean, it's not bad. It's called Young, Gifted, and White. And the song is a satire of white privilege run amok. So I tell anyone, I go, to me, when I heard it, it reminded me of things like Kinky Friedman. You know, I've been a fan of his for years. And even the people who wrote for Orbit magazine were satirists. So to me, it's a great satirical piece that it seems only to get better with age, sadly. And hopefully we can move past that period. But it's just so many great tracks on here. And the thing that's really sad to me is that, you know, you listen to some of them and you go, man, like, why didn't that get further? You know, what was it in that period? There's just some of them that I know could have been radio hits. I mean, I think RUR's Go Baby, and I have many people say that to me. They go, that was like the single. That's one of the best tracks to come out of this scene.
Are many of these artists still around?
You know, some of them have passed on. Sadly, the man known as Bootsy X, or Robert Mulrooney, who is in several of the bands, if you look at the liner notes, he passed a few years ago. There's a couple other people who have also passed who were musicians. The majority of them now, you know, since this is 40 years on, are all in their 60s. Some are nearing 70. So some have passed. Some of them did, you know, in that scene have a decent amount of substance use, which led to their early demise. But a lot of them are still out. So, for example, Cinecide still plays. They've been around since 1976, and they do a great job. I actually used to work with those guys, too, full disclosure. They used to own a place called Thomas Video, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, we had mentioned Wayne Kramer, another notable name who's on this collection, although he wasn't using that name then, is Don Was. Mm-hmm. And Don Was, of course, very well known around here, Was Not Was, now the president of Blue Note Records, comes to town every year and hosts the Concert of Colors Super Session, where he puts together all these great Detroit acts. He had a band in 77, 78 called The Traitors that were part of a three-band bill that he was going out and trying to book into various places. It didn't last too long. It only lasted about 6 months. But there's a really fascinating demo that they did. They did a version of Money, the Motown song everybody probably knows. And it's a burner. It's 90 seconds, and it's great. So there's all kinds of really fascinating things on here. Another band that's on here that they still play out is the Reruns, but they're known better, especially in Hamtramck and Metro Detroit, as the Polish Muslims. And the Polish Muslims have been around since 1981 or 82, and they do kind of parody rock, kind of playing on their Polish heritage, you know, references to pierogi and kielbasa and punchkis and whatnot. Their band, the Reruns, just amazing 77-style power pop band, just fantastic stuff.
I guess old punks never really get old. They just become Polish Muslims.
You know, the thing that's really funny, I was talking to a friend of mine who was more in the hardcore scene. And I said, the thing that I find fascinating is if you look at the hardcore scene, a lot of those guys moved on to do other things. So, for example, John Brannon and Negative Approach, until just recently reviving Negative Approach, went and had the Laughing Hyenas, which was more kind of post-punk. The guys in the Necros started Big Chief, which was sort of this amalgam between sort of the Stooges and Funkadelic back in the 80s and 90s. So hardcore kind of seemed to last a few years, and then it got restrictive. It seems like hardcore was important, but there wasn't a lot of space for people to grow creatively. So they went back and they found the older forms. They got into blues, they got into funk, they got into all that stuff. But some of these bands, like the Seatbelts that are on here, Cinecide, they still play. So I think that there was something about this era that in some ways was a return to the more raucous late 50s, early 60s roots of rock and roll, with adding their own spin to it that I think is still very vital for a lot of them.
You mentioned the fact that there was cross-pollination definitely among bands in Detroit and bands in New York, but largely so many of these bands were geographically cut off from the LA scene, the New York scene. When you listen to these tracks, what do you think was the end result of that isolation?
I think that it forced them to be creative in their own manner in which they were going to put the stuff out. So, for example, just being self-funded in terms of putting out the singles or getting a bunch of bands together and chipping in to put comps together or going into places and booking shows, you know, that started the scene. I mean, it really forced them to think creatively and to use that sort of Detroit work ethic in a way. I think another reason why this scene in Detroit in particular didn't have the ability to branch out is that some of the bands were able to tour. So, for example, like Flirt and the Mutants played New York quite a bit. They played Max's Kansas City. I think several of them also played CBGB's. I think the Cult Heroes did as well. But as we know around here, the problem was, you know, the touring infrastructure wasn't there. So there wasn't a lot of money to be made. And obviously being in New York, you had a base for that. You had the media and all of the other things that go along with it. I think here it was a little bit harder to kind of get out of the Midwest bubble and to get the attention, even though Cream magazine at the time, which was from Detroit, did write about some of these bands, but it just didn't seem to take.
Yeah. Although we should say, like so many of these bands, it really wasn't necessarily about the money for them.
No, it was just about the ability to be able to create and go have a good time. And I think that that's really the takeaway. Like, I've told people that my effort around telling this history, if there's a couple of serious lessons that are in there, it's that you can do it, anyone can do it, and you should do it. I remember Jerry Vile, who does The Dirty Show, who was the guy who published Orbit magazine I did the book about. He talked about how he became the singer of the band called The Boners. And he said, look, you know, we saw Iggy and said, if he can do that, so can we. So why not? And that to me, I think, is the lesson. It's like, you don't have to wait for someone to come down and sort of tap you on the shoulder and say, okay, it's your time now. It's like, no, go do it. And I think that's important. I think from a music history here in Detroit, the legacy of venues is really important when we talk about this history, because the fact that the guys who booked Bookies went on to become the guys who took St. Andrew's Hall and turned it into a concert venue, a mid-level concert venue, that is huge. Because before then, there was really only local bars, and then there was Kobo or the Masonic Temple. And if you were a local band, there wasn't a lot of room for you, because you were probably not going to be able to sell out 4,000 seats, but you could probably do a bit better than 100.
Yeah.
So, you know, where was the room to have that flexibility? And I think these guys really, when they went into that club in early 78, had no idea that they were going to change the way venues and booking and all of that happens here in the city.
I imagine it's got to be challenging to think about mastering a collection of punk songs. I mean, you don't want them to sound too good, but these sound really great. I see you did them at Third Man Mastering in Detroit by no less than Warren DeFever.
Yeah, Warren's great. His name is alive, going on 30 years right now. If you're not hip to him, I mean, just an amazing musician, amazing sound engineer. Originally on 4AD when he first came out in 1990. Of course, that label gave us bands such as the Pixies and Cocteau Twins and all kinds of great stuff over in the UK. So he's been doing great stuff on his own, but he's one of the master mixers over at Third Man, and I had a Prest over there as well. So I just decided, you know, let's keep it all in Detroit. I had worked on some other vinyl projects also in the past with a label that I have, and I had also worked with the other Detroit pressing plant before, Archer Records, who I have mad respect for Mike Archer and the work he does over there.
It's so tricky to think about mastering and remastering punk records. Because, I mean, there's a lot that you don't want to lose. How did you guys go about it?
Well, the thing is that some of these came from 7 inches that I was able to collect Probably the most expensive one was the Cult Heroes. I bought a really mint copy on Discogs for about $100 just so I could have that track. But it was about, you know, I would have to say probably half the record comes off of things that I got my hands on that were 7-inch records or comps, and they had to be pulled from that and then cleaned up a little bit. A lot of the master tapes are gone. Some of these bands, you know, the stuff got thrown out or misplaced or who knows where it is. Some of it was digital. They had transferred it at some point to save it and then to send me files. So Warren just did a really amazing job in helping make it sound really rich and full. And my biggest thing for me was like, how do I put all this together? How do I have it make logical sense? And I had a couple of different rules in terms of how I, you know, come up with the tracks and how the track order was going to be. My thing was I didn't want two bands that sounded similar to each other next to each other because I didn't want them to kind of blend into each other and you go, oh, was that the same band twice? No. So there was a couple of rules I had kind of set for myself in terms of how I really wanted this to sound, and they just captured it. I mean, between him and Bill Skibbe, who was the engineer who cut the lacquer plates that eventually the record was pressed from, they just did a fantastic job over there.
It's nice. Was that part of what you were able to get out of the funding for the project? Was a really loving mastering job?
That was the thing for me. I went down and I did all the budgeting on this and I said, right, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. We're going to have a really nice cover, really nice design, liner notes. It's going to be two LPs. It's going to be 180-gram vinyl. It's going to sound great. It's going to sound better than, you know, the folks who put this out originally remember. You know, I want to impress the bands themselves and make sure that they're happy with it first, because if they're not happy with it, I mean, what's the point, right? It doesn't matter what I want, you know, this is their art. It should be showcased in the manner in which, you know, they feel that it showcases their abilities and what they were doing at the time. So I really went out of my way to make sure that it was there, and that's what that funding did. Also, just, I have to say, just being part of the ecosystem of the Night Arts Challenge also opened a lot of doors where people started reaching out to me and like, oh, I've got this, I've got that. You should talk to this person. You should talk to that person. There's at least 4 or 5 tracks on this record that I would not have had if it hadn't been for that, because my knowledge is only so deep and I was only talking to certain people, as many people as I could try to find, right? And the great thing was, is when the word got out, people started coming to me.
The name of this new double album set is The End of the Night. It is 29 tracks from Detroit punk bands circa 1976 to 1983. We've been talking to Rob St. Mary, who pulled the project together. You can learn a lot more at the website that he built, DetroitPunkArchive.com. Rob, thank you so much for doing this, and we can hear all the love that you put into it.
Thank you for taking the time. It means a lot.